This episode is sponsored by The Bridge to Recovery, a nonprofit program on 115 acres near Bowling Green, Kentucky, a tranquil place where they've been changing lives for over 40 years. Their people improve their quality of life by acknowledging past emotional wounds and healing from all forms of trauma. The CEO, Paul Hamlin, has been a friend of mine for 20 years. Call him directly at 858-945-7848. That's 858-945-7848. Or you can learn more about The Bridge to Recovery by clicking the link in the show notes or visiting thebridgetorecovery.com. Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm Rose Guerrero, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
Thanks for tuning in. I'm Tom Gentry. So, this episode is with a young woman named Rose Guerrero, who is the director of research at the Palm Beach County Historical Society. And we had this conversation on April 7th. And as of April 7th, there were 378,289 cases of COVID-19 confirmed in the United States. As I record this, today is the 15th, and there are 594,207 cases confirmed in the United States. And probably by tomorrow, there will be over 2 million cases globally. So, crazy stuff. Such a difficult time we live in. So, Rose, who again works for the Palm Beach County Historical Society, I encountered her. Somehow I started following their account on Instagram. I live and work in West Palm Beach, if you're new to the show. And I saw she did a video, and just like every other industry, her job has gone offsite, working from home. And so this was a good opportunity for us to have a conversation. You know, the idea of having a historian on the show, first of all, I love history. So I kind of nerded out with her a little bit, talking about history. But it's also one of those professions that you don't hear a lot about. And, you know, could be something that, you know, somebody out there might really be interested in doing with their lives. And it just goes to show that they're just a wealth of options that we have as human beings with what we decide to do with our lives and our professions. So anyway, Rose Guerrero, hope you enjoy it.
Just the products and bad seeds.
Rose, how you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. It's a weird world we're currently in, but I feel very blessed with where I'm at right now and that we can stay home and stay safe. So, doing really well.
Yeah, me too. You know, I feel pretty fortunate in that I am working, and it has, this whole thing hasn't really slowed me down professionally at all. So
great.
At least not yet. So fingers crossed.
Oh, if anything, it's propelled me.
Well, that's good.
There were some really great ideas. So
why don't you tell the listeners, who you are and what you do?
Well, I'm Rose Guerrero. I'm the research director for the Historical Society of Palm Beach County, which sounds like a really big title and a really big concept of what is even a historical society? What do we do? And I always like to say we are the history library for our community, for our county. We are twofold. We are a historical society and we're also a museum. So unfortunately, during this time, our museum is closed because people can't, you know, we're following social distancing. But we're this repository of our history, of Palm Beach County history, South Florida history. And so kind of my job is to know and learn this history and make it accessible to our community, to people that are just trying to figure out where they are, what they're, you know, where they might live, some fun stories they might want to learn about. And that's pretty much my task, is to make sure that I can make it accessible, make it easy to understand, and help people, you know, learn a little bit about the area and the community.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting place. I moved here from Indiana in the mid-90s. And I always, I like history a lot. So, and, you know, wherever I travel, I always want to know a little bit about where I am. It just helps me feel more connected, you know?
But yeah, and that's the whole purpose of Historical Society, really, is to make you feel connected where you are. Because people did what you did. People moved from Indiana down to South Florida to Palm Beach County, you know, years ago, and they've been making this place their home. And that's what I kind of like about what I do, is that I can make connections with people.
Yeah, that's great. So how is it you came to do this for a living?
I went to school. I always loved history. History was always my favorite subject, actually. So I was homeschooled my whole childhood, all the grade levels, you know, from elementary to high school. And I graduated when I was about 17. And when I graduated, I wanted to be a forensic anthropologist. So I had like a big dream about, you know, learning about different cultures. I love different cultures. I love learning about different people and their stories and places. So I went to college for that. I actually got my master's degree in anthropology. I love how we consume food. So that's really what my master's degree is about, is actually of why we eat what we eat. So I have a specialty in something called zooarchaeology. So I specialize in how people consume food in the past. My thesis was about Bahamian culture, a European colony that settled in the Bahamas, and how they survived. Did they survive very well? You know, and I discovered that they didn't survive very well in my thesis. So, so that seems like such a tangent from where I am today, but it's history, right?
Yeah, everything, you know, that food's people one of those things, you know, that we don't think of as having a role in history, but it really does.
Huge. Yeah. Yeah, it has a huge role. And, you know, how you survive is really a part of the story of why you live where you live, or even, you know, why you left where you left, because your food resources are, you know, not accessible, or, you know, there's new, you know, places where you can get your food resources. I mean, the thought of where do you choose to buy your house? Is it close to a Whole Foods or even a Trader Joe's or a Publix or so forth? Like, maybe that's why you chose where to have your house, because of those types of things. And, you know, maybe not fully, you know, it's maybe more subconscious than anything else, but that's something I've always been intrigued by, you know. Tangent or not.
Well, and if you think about it, I mean, the whole way that, you know, when the Europeans came to this part of the world, I mean, you know, they were looking for spices.
Right. Well, yeah. So, you know, people's movements and so forth. I mean, it is always, I always link everything back to food resources and so forth. I'm a big eater of so many different ethnic foods and so forth. So I love the idea of subsistent patterns.
So
that's what I went to school for, and I have a master's degree in that. And for a while, I was teaching high school biology at a really amazing program school called Pace Center for Girls. And I taught, I think, almost 3 years. And that was a really great opportunity for me to experience the real world in what kind of what education was like for, what community actually needed when it comes to education and understanding your own history and your own stories. So I always link history back to telling our stories, telling our history. And that means talking about what mom and dad did or what grandma and grandpa learned and so forth. And being an educator was a really big part of that, of learning that process. Because in school, there's a triangle of needs. And so sometimes you need to tell your story to help you make connections with what you're learning. And so when I was an educator, when I was a teacher, I feel today that that was a really great step for me to see, you know, teenagers trying to understand who they were as individuals. And by, you know, learning their own history stories of themselves, that helped them, you know, better make connections with what they were learning in class. Because really, who cares about, you know, Columbus sailed the ocean blue, you know, those types of things if, you know, you don't know your own story of where you came from or, you know,
right.
What mom and dad, why mom and dad are the way they are and so forth, or grandma or grandpa, you know, why did they have the struggles that they had, you know, everything is connected, and that's something that being a teacher taught me. So I was a teacher for about 3 years. And then I got this just really great opportunity to be the education coordinator for the Historical Society of Palm Beach County. So that's how I started with the Historical Society. I was their education coordinator for about 3 years. And over the last year, I've just now moved into being their research director. So being their education coordinator allowed me to step back from being in the classroom and more of a participant of making resources available for teachers and know their needs and getting them history content.
You started as, did you say, the education coordinator?
Yes.
And then
the education coordinator. And then I've been with the Historical Society for 4 years. And coming in May, for the last year, I've been their research director.
So what does a research director for a county historical society do?
So I just want to make a clarification about when we think about counties, we sometimes think of it as being a government entity, and we are not a government entity. We are a nonprofit organization. So we work off of the kindness of people's hearts and their generosity of wanting to preserve and learn about their history. So the day in the life of a research director at a historical society varies greatly. My main job is to make our archives available to the public, as well as do research for people. So I get phone calls, I get emails about just simple history questions about our community, for example. I had a question a couple of days ago, someone asking who was the first lawyer in Palm Beach County. And while that might seem like a very simple, straightforward, well, it was so-and-so, it's a complex question, because when we think about our area, we have to think about the multi-layered community that we live in, and that we weren't always the Palm Beach County area. We were actually part of Dade County in the late 1800s. So I had to dive a little bit deeper of what they were actually looking for. It turns out this was a mom during this time frame that we're currently in. She was helping her daughter do a research paper. And so she wanted to know who was technically the first lawyer when we became Palm Beach County in 1909, when we became our own county. So I do lots of different ways of finding things. I have lots of different search engines, not just the internet. The internet's great and it's full of stuff, but it's vast and it doesn't always have things that are not available to the layman. We have city directories and books that, you know, aren't available. And so that's usually what I use to do my research, is books that aren't in print anymore, books that we have in our archives, city directories or city documentation that we've collected over time that I use to answer some of these simple questions, which means that it takes more than just 10 minutes of, you know, Googling to find the answer for some people. That's part of what I do. I also help people find information about their homes. You might actually live in a historic house, which is really amazing because Palm Beach County is full of so much history, and we never think of it. You know, we have homes that are over 100 years old, homes that were designed by some very famous architects. And so I help people learn a little bit more about what the homes that they live in. I help architects because I think we might have one of the largest collections of Addison Meissner architectural drawings in our repositories. And those are 100-year-old architectural drawings, because Addison Meissner was an architect and he came down to Palm Beach County in 1919. So, very famous architect for Palm Beach, the island. And people love to look at those. But they're you can't, because they're 100 years old. So I help people learn a little bit more about the history of the area, maybe guide them in the right direction. Sometimes I don't have the answers to some of their questions, but I might know someone that might. So my job is to point people in the right direction and get them excited about what they're learning. Because sometimes, you know, we need a little fire behind us to help us do some research.
Bring it to life a little bit, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, sometimes you look at something or you've heard a story or you've heard about some history thing and it's, you know, it's very flat and not dynamic. And sometimes you need a little, maybe you need a old photo behind it to make it seem interesting, right, or make it feel connected, make you feel connected to it. Or, you know, we have 3D object collections. We have an entire warehouse full of 3D objects. Some really amazing, you know, fashion designers of Palm Beach County, or furniture that, you know, would be sold at an antique store type stuff that we collected through the years.
So is there a specific range of time where most of your work is focused, or how modern does your research get?
Well, if we get back to the very beginning, people have been here for over 12,000 years. So we do have material of our ancient peoples that were here in South Florida. And then it goes all the way up to present time. What's going on even today, we're collecting that material. I'm clipping newspapers even right now of the historic moments that we're all experiencing right now. I mean, this time period is truly historic. These are things that we are going to be talking about with our grandchildren, and our great grandchildren are going to be asking these questions. And this is going to be written into history books. Nothing like this has happened in our lifespans, right? There's few people that are still alive that remember the Spanish influenza outbreak in 1918, 1919, and so forth, which I always like to say that history is very cyclical, and it's so funny that it's 2020 and everyone was so excited about the roaring 20s of 2020, right?
Right.
I had this conversation with my supervisor the other day where we were talking about why everyone was so excited about us living in the roaring 20s, and she always makes this comment that she says, you know, I don't understand why people like the roaring 20s. Nothing good was really happening back then. It really was a very difficult time in the United States in the 1920s. So now I think about what's going on now in 2020.
Oh my gosh.
It's
brutal.
We're reliving a lot of things. We're reliving really difficult times. You have a huge period of time in Palm Beach County. If you just think about what was going on in Palm Beach County in the 1920s, we're talking about, we're just resolving coming out of World War
One.
And so World War One just ends, right? 1919, World War One ends. So in the 1920s, you know, you have, things seem like they're getting better. You know, there's a lot of the, what we call the boom era, people buying up land left and right. You have land speculators lining the streets in Palm Beach, actually trying to sell this land to people blind. They're purchasing land without even looking at it and don't realize that they're buying swamp. It's great. And then you have two major natural disasters. 1926, you get a hurricane that goes through Miami and it's full of destruction. I mean, let's talk about millions and millions of dollars of land that's destroyed by one hurricane. Not only people are spending all this money and dumping all this investment in South Florida. And then you have the 1928 hurricane, so that's a back-to-back hurricane. I think the 1928 hurricane is considered the third greatest historic hurricane that is recorded in the United States. I could be, I'm not sure of specifically, but I know it's one of the largest recorded hurricanes in the United States, and it had a huge death toll. Over 3,000 people die in one storm. And so that's when boom goes bust in the 1920s. 1928 ends investment, and then you have stock market crash
right.
A year later. So whenever I hear anything about the roaring 20s, I'm like, yeah. Oh yeah, it was roaring. People were crying, you know? And so what's going on now in 2020, history is alive. It's fluid. We think of it as, a lot of us think of it as a timeline, right? We think of all that happened and, you know, you give a date and you say a name of some famous person that made their name during that time frame. But there's stories and stories of just regular people, you know, your neighbor that's collected photos and journals and so forth of their own life experiences. And those are real lives. And so a county historical society is collecting real life stories that everyone really should share, because even if they're not a famous name that you would know right off the top of your head or written in a history book, their stories are important and they should be preserved. And so that's one of the major things that we do, is make sure that everyday life gets preserved, because that's really the story of a group of people, right? Mm-hmm. It's not so much what one individual did to change things, it's the group entity of people that persevered through situations.
Right. Well, you know, one thing I want to touch on a little bit, you know, this being a podcast, it's mm-hmm. not really local. I mean, people have listened right. to this all over the world. So
right.
when people who have never been here to Palm Beach County, or they just, you know very little about Palm Beach County, in my experience, in recent times, well, probably now they think of Donald Trump and Mar-a-Lago. I think
right.
They make that association. And before that, another big one was, I mean, I was here for the 2000 election, the hanging Chad.
The hanging Chad. We have those in our museum. It's great, you know. Yeah. And again, that's the collective story, right, that we all can share, because the United States all experienced that, right?
Yeah.
Everyone experiences our president and what, you know, where he lives, and we all know that area. I mean, everyone knows Mar-a-Lago because of Donald Trump. And honestly, no one would have known about Mar-a-Lago if it wasn't for Donald Trump, because that house would have been torn down in the 80s.
Like all the other houses
in that area.
You think it would have been torn down?
Oh, absolutely.
Because who was that? Margaret Meriwether Post, who?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's Margaret Meriwether Post, you know, Post Dynasty, the cereal that you eat.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, there were homes owned by the Dodge family or the Vanderbilts and so forth, and all these other way bigger names that all got torn down. There were houses bigger than Mar-a-Lago that got torn down, more expensive, more grandiose that got torn down. I mean, that house was owned by the government before it got resold off to, got returned to the Post family. And it probably would have gotten, you know, like most areas on the island, it would have gotten split up, and other very beautiful homes would have been built on top of where that house was. And honestly, who cares who lives in that house, or has he turned that house into a club? It's a beautiful piece of history.
Yeah.
As gaudy as can be, and it's perfect for what the era that it was built for. You know, Marjorie Meriwether Post wanted it like that. She hired Joseph Urban, who was this interior designer. He wasn't even technically an interior designer. He was a designer for theater.
Hmm.
And so that's why it's so gaudy. He was a theater designer. You know, when you go to a play, and if you sit in the back of a play, you want to be able to see the stage.
Right.
And so they paint things really bright, and, you know, they make it really gaudy so you can actually see it. So that's what I think of when I think of, you know, Mar-a-Lago. It's cool. It's meant to be looked at. That was what it was designed for. That's what Marjorie Meriwether Post wanted it for, you know. She told the other, who was it? She had architect that designed it was Marion Sims Wyatt, and he wasn't grandiose enough for her, so that's why she put Joseph Urban on it.
Wow. So
yeah.
We know those things are kind of in some ways emblematic of the area for people who are, you know, not living here or don't know a lot about the community. What else is there that you would want, you know, are there things that stand out about the Palm Beaches that you would want other, you know, to share historically?
I'm working on a few stories right now where I want to share stories that are talking about overcoming adversity. And I think every community has this, you know, when communities are built, they're built from ingenuity and people that work really hard. And you only start hearing about certain names towards the end, like a Henry Flagler, right? So for people that don't know the area, I always want to remind them that it was regular people that built up an area, a community. It was people that put in hard work to make an area their home. For people that are not from the area, stories that I love are, oh goodness, there's so many. There's the Thomas and Priscilla Peppers, African-American couple that came to Palm Beach in the 1890s that made this area their home. There's people that started out with nothing, and, you know, the Lanharts, the Potters, names that you wouldn't become familiar with until you got here. everyone knows how beautiful our area is when they think about the environment. And if you can remember only one thing, you can remember that's why people showed up down here, right? It's because the environment is so engaging and beautiful and made people want to stay. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, why else would you want to stay in an area that gets to be 105 degrees in the summer?
Yeah.
You know, it was beautiful, you know, and you have your beaches and so forth. And I really just want people to remember that the energy behind individuals, what people work to accomplish, is the same type of thing that you work today to accomplish. You know, no one's changed. No one's, you know, personality or character is different than your own, that something you can't do yourself. And that's what I really love about history, is that, you know, you hear about these people and you wonder, well, how did Henry Flagler, let's just bring up Henry Flagler, right? Henry Flagler is a multi-billionaire that started playing with trains in his 60s. Mm-hmm. You know, he started with Standard Oil and then becomes a millionaire that way, and, you know, with the Rockefellers, and then comes to South Florida with railroads, you know, after, you know, then he gets interested in resorts and building hotels and so forth. But what kind of personality, you know, is that? That, you know, he started with nothing. I think he had, like, he came from a poor family. He interned or, you know, worked trade to start Standard Oil. And he saw an opportunity. I think that's what it is opportunity. Once you see the opportunity, even if it's just like the crack of a door, you know, some people just jump at that crack of the door. And there's, you know, some people become multimillionaires and some people leave a really great story to find later on.
Mm. Well, and for people who don't know, you know, he built the Florida East Coast Railroad. All the way to Key West, which,
he did.
You know, there was no way to get to all of the Keys.
Yeah.
Besides by boat to get. Before then.
By boat. Yeah. By boat. There wasn't even, the stagecoach wasn't even around until Henry Flagler showed up because of him.
And then.
It would have eventually happened, but it would have taken longer, right. You know?
And then
whole goal was to get to the Caribbean. You know, his whole goal was actually to build an overseas railroad. I think he wanted to get to Havana.
Oh, wow.
He wanted to do trade with Havana. And, you know, he died in, what was it, 1914. But he never got that dream. But he got the dream of the Keys.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing. And he just dotted the coastline with these opulent hotels, you know, mm-hmm. starting in St. Augustine and then eventually getting to the Breakers here. And I know there's another one in Miami, right? That I can't.
Yes. I'm trying to remember what his hotel called. It wasn't a Biltmore. I don't remember the ones in Miami. I grew up born and raised in Miami. I can't remember half the history of Miami, you know, the amounts of years that I spent living there versus, you know, the 4+ years working where I am now. So,
well, you know, one of the things that I think about with Palm Beach County, I read a book years ago, called The Swamp by Michael Grunwald.
Yeah.
And it's about the centuries long effort to drain the Everglades.
Mm-hmm.
And for people who don't know, you know, Palm Beach County, is, what is it? It's one of the largest counties in the country, right? It's enormous.
I think it's the third largest county, first largest east of the Mississippi.
Okay.
So I think there are a few counties that are a little bit larger, but we are the largest county in Florida, and part of it is because we've where we have a portion of Lake Okeechobee.
Right. Right. And you know, you mentioned that hurricane in 1926 or 28.
The 28, yeah.
And that was related to the effort to contain Lake Okeechobee and drain the Everglades. And then when that dike burst, it drowned all these people. And that's
well, there was no dike. So there was like a natural dike around Lake Okeechobee that couldn't hold what was going on. So for people that are unfamiliar with how hurricanes work, the major problem with hurricanes is so much the rain or the wind factors. It's very much the storm surge that it creates. So it creates pressure. So think of Lake Okeechobee as a bowl. It's a very shallow but very large lake. And so what the hurricane did was it pushed all the water from one side of the lake all the way to the other. So it created a storm surge of all this water that pooled on one side and basically created like a tsunami that flooded the south end of Lake Okeechobee and the areas that were there, Pahokee, Belglade, and so forth. And so people drowned. And they don't even know the number of people that drowned because this was, if you're unfamiliar with Pahokee and Belglade, they are where our agricultural district is.
Sugar.
And so the majority of people that were there were immigrants and people that were working in the fields from the Caribbean or from, you know, actually from up north. So lots of families that had come down to work in the fields during harvest time frame. And so they, you know, they weren't part of a census. So you don't even, they stopped counting. They stopped counting the bodies. And there were huge, you know, piles that they burned.
Well, there's a mass grave near 25th Street over here. Yeah.
There's two mass graves. There's one at Woodlawn, and then there's one up by 5th Street. Yeah. And there's monuments for all of that because lots of them were African Americans that weren't being counted. So, you know, lots of families that were destroyed that never knew what happened to their family members. That was a very difficult time frame, you know, 1928, that huge storm. So we had a really great president then, right? We had an engineer for president, Hoover, was the president there. You know, we all think of like the Hoover Dam, but that's actually what the dike around Lake Okeechobee is named after. It's called the Hoover Dike. And then you have the Army Corps of Engineers coming in and reinforcing. And in fact, I think it's not even 100% complete. The dike's been being built since 1928, right? And so it's not even complete for what it means. If another 1928 hurricane came through, potentially the same catastrophic experience could happen.
Wow. All right, so we got the Everglades. What else stands out to you that other people around the world might be interested to know about Palm Beach County?
You know, we always think of, maybe we talk about different architectural structures or historic districts. They're, you know, We're not young. We're not a young area. We always think of South Florida as being very young. You know, we have one of the oldest cities, St. Augustine here. We had Native peoples that were making this place their home. This was one of the first places that Europeans showed up to try to colonize and turn into, you know, Spanish colony or a French colony or an English colony. We went through so many different time frames of that. There's so much history here. There's archaeological excavations all over the place. There's so much that has not been uncovered. When we think of United States history, American history, we might think of colonial periods and, you know, we don't think so much about South Florida and what we were going through or, you know, the fact that, you know, the Seminole Wars occurred here, those time periods that kind of get lost in the shuffle of other things that people might think are more important or, you know, or more interesting. Because not a lot of people were in South Florida, right? Or Florida, to be exact. You know, Florida was unoccupied by the United States until what, we purchased it from
Spain, right? It was Spain, right?
Yeah, I believe it was. I'm trying to remember who had it at that time. Was it Spain or England? It went back and forth several times during the early 1800s, right? And then it was by the 1820s, it was finally owned by the United States. 1840, I think, is when we become a state. 20 years later, right, 1860, we have the Civil War. Florida was the second or third state to secede from the Union. So we don't even, sometimes, in my own personal experience as a historian, or, you know, going in, you know, and teaching history, we kind of, everyone thinks that Florida is so young. Mm-hmm. And they don't make a connection to the state of Florida being part of the United States history as a whole, because we think of so much the older states, right, or where more our forefathers were spending more time. But Florida was always doing something. Something's always occurring in Florida. You know, third state to secede from the Union. Yeah, we had a lot going on during the Civil War over here, because we had just ended a war with the Seminoles. You know, we were still trying to, you know, embrace the Native people that had made Florida their home as well. So you have pioneers that are trying to settle the area, trying to make peace with the Seminoles and the Miccosukees that are here. And then you have us, you know, fighting our own people during the Civil War.
Right.
So, and people in Palm Beach County, you know, I always focus back on Palm Beach County because we're pretty old in the South Florida area. It was one of the first stopping grounds people would make before they made their way further south. You know, you have Jacksonville and Titusville that are cities that people actually had, you know, made their homes and actually had easy access. There was a railroad there by the late 1800s, or there was some type of form of transportation was easy to access, and everything south of that was so hard to get to. So everyone, you know, how to use a boat. You mentioned that, you know, Henry Flagler changes everything because he brings railroads down. Well, the invention of the railroad is great for the United States, right? So I think of sometimes that we think that Florida is so disconnected to all other historical things that are occurring in the United States, but we were just as impacted by things.
Yeah. Two of the oldest European settlements, St. Augustine and Pensacola.
Yep.
You know, I think they fight over which one's the oldest.
Right. If you're talking about those things, you know, it's funny.
It is. Yeah. Yeah. Well, it just speaks to the attachment that people have to their history and the pride associated with it, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's what I love, is that we make these connections and it makes us feel like we're a part of it, you know? When we talk about where we come from, or that our own history, or, you know, where did grandma and grandpa come from, or, you know, oral histories are really great about that. If you've ever listened to an oral history, if you haven't had the opportunity to listen to an oral history, your historical society is one of the first places to go. If you've never heard someone talk about their own life experiences when they came to an area, and that gives you a really great opportunity to hear just a regular, someone that you would think, you know, oh, that's just my neighbor, you know, that they, I see them every once in a while, you know, taking their mail out or getting their groceries type stuff. When you hear someone's story of where they came from, and the experiences they went through, you can relate so much to your own trials and your own experiences that you've had to overcome. These oral histories allow you to see how places are built up. There was Max Greenberg's oral history. It's really fascinating. It sounds like a regular guy. You know, Max Greenberg came to South Florida. His family came from Europe. He immigrated here in the early 1900s. And he starts a grocery store, you know, just a regular grocery store. 1928 hurricane comes by and it destroys his grocery store. So he gets the opportunity to reinvent himself. And he reinvents himself as a linens guy. So he starts seeing what people actually need. So he creates Pioneer Linens. Hmm. And then in 1928 on Clematis Street, which is in West Palm Beach. And it becomes the oldest. It is one of the oldest stores in West Palm Beach that's still family-owned today, still owned by the Greenberg family. And if you hear him tell his story of everything he's experienced, his mother died from Spanish influenza. He walked the streets of Clematis when it was being redesigned. If you look at your own neighborhood in the eyes of someone that's lived through it several years ago, and you start seeing how things have changed, you start experiencing it through their eyes, and you start seeing that history isn't so far distant from where you are today.
You know, it's funny. I work out of an office on Clematis Street. Well, I did on Monday nights.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think. I think it's 310 Clematis. Okay. I'm drawing a blank on the name of the building, but it's one of the oldest buildings in the city. And, I think it's 6 floors, you know, Gilded Age, little elevators and, but all over the halls, there are all these photographs, black and white photographs of West Palm Beach years ago. And,
they're probably all from us.
Yeah. Well, it's funny because, you know, we were looking at them. I was there with a couple clients the last time, I was able to work there on a Monday, and we were looking at these photographs and it was of the building we're in and the block that we were on. And, you know, we could look across the street. And we could tell from the pictures there had been a putt-putt golf. Right across the street.
I know the photo you're talking about. I've given it to people so many different times. Yes, the putt-putt golf course. Yeah, that was during the 1920s, 1930s actually, because they had a tear down. The building that it wasn't going to be used anymore. We're talking about the Depression era. Right. So they had to find cheap ways to entertain yourself and they could have putt-putt golf. You know, you wouldn't think of that today in the middle of Clematis Street.
No. Yeah. And for people who don't know, Clematis Street is kind of the main east-west thoroughfare through downtown West Palm Beach. Really lively, sort of beautiful street. It's really... Mm-hmm. You know, and there are some really cool buildings.
It was the center street. It was Main Street for West Palm Beach. All of West Palm Beach started out in this neighborhood type aspect. I think Clematis Street was one of the first streets to be determined, you know, and mapped out in 1894. Wow. And so then people started putting their stores on that street, which is great, you know, and it's still around today. And buildings that were being built in the 1920s are still there. You've got so many really nice, you know, Anthony's. If you've seen that one, that's the Marvel building. I'm trying to remember what block that's on. If it's on the 300 block of Clematis.
Well, there's the Harvey Building, which is, I think, the oldest.
Harvey Building.
And then, well, and there are lots of, if you look, you know, there are lots of Art Deco buildings scattered around.
1930s and so forth, there was a lot of Art Deco expression. You know, it's the Armory Art Building in West Palm Beach, which it's great, right? It's called the Armory Art Building, but it was a armory for the National Guards in the 1940s. It was built during the 1930s for the armory. And so I've got photos of World War II veterans, you know, the World War II soldiers, you know, standing outside up for their muster, you know. And it's an art building now. Isn't it so great how we, you know, reuse buildings for things today.
It's funny, you know, it's this beautiful Art Deco complex that, you know, you wouldn't think of as a National Guard armory at all.
Yeah.
And they've turned it into a art learning center, you know, where they have lots of classes and they have artists in residence and all sorts of stuff.
It's really great. Great that they've done that. We've got actually Dreyfus School of the Arts technically it's the second school in West Palm Beach, but it was the first designated built for school. It was central school in West Palm Beach, and it was designed, you know, they used a lot of Addison Meisner home buildings that were there and so forth to include in that campus, which is great. You know, some of the I don't think people really think about South Florida when they think about architecture. That's something else, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, you might think of Art Deco, you might think of Miami and their Art Deco there. You don't, you know, the Renaissance Revival style architecture that Addison Meisner invented, basically, of using, you know, Mediterranean Revival style or Spanish Mission style homes, which the huge neighborhoods that are basically the Spanish style houses from the 1920s. All of those, like you got Flamingo Park, you've got Mangonia, which is huge with their Spanish Mission style homes. What is El Cid? All these historic districts, Grandview Heights, you know, really amazing architectural design.
There's some beautiful neighborhoods. There really
are. Really beautiful neighborhoods that, you know, fits in perfectly with the environment that we are, you know. So.
Absolutely.
Things like that, I think, are really great.
So any big goals for you with the Historical Society at this point? What's the big project you're working on now?
So we're kind of in a new time frame, right? We're looking at how do we connect with our community digitally without, you know, being physically able to include people in what we're doing. So our major place of connecting with our community really was our museum, the Richard and Pat Johnson Palm Beach County History Museum. And
which now was that originally a courthouse?
It was. It's actually, so it's a 1916 courthouse is where we have our offices in our museum, which is a beautiful, you know, a neoclassical building. So you've got these beautiful columns outside and this yellow bricking building. But so what do you do now when you can't invite your community into a building? Well, you invite them into a story. So I'm working on ways of engaging our the world and, you know, with our history. And you know, we need distractions right now. We need things to help us get through what we're getting through right now. And I like to use history to help us have a better perspective of what's going on, because we've gone through adversity. And when I say we, I mean the collective we, the world, has experienced really tough times in the past. And we've gotten through them, and that's what we're going to do now, is we're going to use the same spirit behind us, the same ingenuity, the same problem-solving skills that we have and have been able to use in the past. We're going to use them again through whatever situation we've already experienced. So I like to tell stories to remind us of what we've already gone through to help us get through what we currently are experiencing with COVID-19. Mm-hmm. And so I'm working on a video series for the Historical Society of Palm Beach County. I'm doing some research on some other people here that have experienced adversity and have overcome it. So I'm writing my scripts with that. Also, I'm in charge of we have a journal, an online journal that we put out twice a year. And so I'm the editor for that, and I'm working on edits for some really great oral histories that are going into that, and two other articles that
tell me the name of that.
It's called the Testanigi.
And
it's actually
that is a native word. What is it?
It is a native word. It's named after one of the first post offices here in Palm Beach County. So if you don't know anything about how places get their names, most areas get their names based off of a post office that's put there. So Palm Beach is named Palm Beach because they named the post office Palm Beach. And then that's how the town got its name. So Testanigi was one of the first post offices in Palm Beach County, but it kind of got forgotten. excuse me.
It's okay.
And then, so we grabbed that name. It's a Native American word, and so we've used it for our journal that we publish.
You have a video series coming out to try to keep people mm-hmm. engaged in this crazy atmosphere of COVID-19.
Yeah, we're showing a bunch of our historic images that we have. We have over a million images and that we've collected over the years of the area. Really wonderful, historic images of places. Also part of my job as a research director is also to help preserve our history. So I've been scanning a lot of our photo collection to digitize so that we can use for the future. Cause film degrades over time. So I'm working on that. I'm preserving a lot of, our photo collection.
Right.
I'm looking at a whole bunch of World War II images, and actually I went through these collections of the American Red Cross in the area of them bringing children to a home that actually still exists. It's called the Children's Crippled Home. And it was for young children that during that time in the 1940s, they had polio.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were bringing them there to get their physical therapy and whatnot and be taken care of at the crippled home because they didn't have, they couldn't walk anymore.
Mm-hmm.
So that's part of some of the things I'm doing these days, from the very nice, comfortable aspect of my own lovely home.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're so well versed in all this, and you talk about it all with such ease. It just seems,
thank you.
Yeah. I mean, it just seems apparent that you love what you do.
Oh, absolutely. I don't think you can do something for years and years and years and do it repeating the process over and over again. For a paycheck. Or you can do something that you love and work as hard as you can to better yourself. That's what I love about this, that I'm learning so much from it just by reading people's history or looking through what they've left behind. Because everyone leaves everything behind, you know. And who's going to pick it up and remember you? Hopefully, I'll get that opportunity to remember people and make sure that other people remember them too.
Mm-hmm. So, is it safe to say there's nothing else you'd rather be doing?
Right now, no.
Yeah, yeah. So, if you had to go back to a different time in your life, if there was a time when the younger Rose needed some encouragement or, you know, the process of becoming this historian that you are over the years, when might that have been? What was going on and what might you tell her?
Oh, I know the exact point. I was a senior in college and I was trying to decide if I was going to go into graduate school or not. And I was having a really difficult time with my studies. And I would go back to this one night. I was having an anxiety attack in my apartment. And I would go up to her and I would tell her, everything works out because you've gone through what you need to go through to get to where you need to be. Everything always works out, and you have the strength in you to achieve what you want to achieve.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. One of the things about getting older is, at least myself, I mean, I freak out a lot less than I ever did. You know, I mean, because of just what you said, because things work out, you know, they might not always work out the way that we want them to, but you know, you're going to be okay. You know?
Yeah.
And I've had to remind myself that, you know, recently with all this stuff going on, because I've, you know, I've worried about the implications of all this COVID-19 stuff, like what's going to happen to this country. And, and, well, you know,
everything is cyclical.
It is. And, you know, and that brings me to one of the things that I love history. You know, I mean, I nerd out on, you know, I went through period where, I really tried to learn as much as I could about Native American history and specifically the systematic dispossession that took place, you know, and their cultures have always really fascinated me. And then more recently, Civil War history. And, you know, I wish more of us paid attention to history, because I feel like if we did, we'd be better human beings today.
Absolutely. Know? There's studies done that, you know, we always like to point out, you know, we focus a lot on teaching history at fourth grade, because once you get the taste for history at an early age, then it's proven statistically that you become invested in your community, which means that you'll be invested in what happens there. You'll become a good citizen and you'll end up, you know, participating in your community because you want to be part of the story. And I think one of the reasons why people aren't interested in history is because they think it's old and it's boring. And what I always want to remind people is history is a story and we're all part of it.
Absolutely. Well, Rose, this has been great. I hope you've enjoyed it.
I absolutely have. Thank you for letting me be part of this conversation.
Well, and I'm sure we'll talk soon. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. If you'd like to learn more about our guest, you can find links in the show notes or visit our website at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, if you have a suggestion for a topic, or you know someone who would make a great guest, email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. If you know someone else who would enjoy the show, or even just a particular episode, please share it with them. Every little bit helps. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider becoming one wherever it is you choose to listen. You can find the show on Patreon, where by becoming a patron, you can hear episodes before they're released publicly. You can gain access to supplemental content. There are other benefits in the various tiers. Visit patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Join our Facebook community or follow the show on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. We also have a YouTube channel. You can connect with us on Twitter or Pinterest. To hear the songs from this and every episode, you can find the Path to Authenticity playlist on Spotify. Obviously, there are a lot of ways you could be spending your time, so I appreciate you spending some of it here with me. I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening. Be nice. To Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.